Okay, so I have probably about 15 slides, and I hope they're going to be educational in a very general sense. And beyond that, we'll see what you want to know about. All right, so the objectives that I have is that by the end of this session, I want you all to know what an antibody is. I want you to know what's different about IgA from every other kind of antibody. I want you to know how we make a diagnosis of selective IgA deficiency. And that's, I think, a really critical point, because there are many people that get diagnosed with selective IgA deficiency that may actually not have it. We're going to talk a little bit about the symptoms of this disorder, and we'll talk about how it's treated. Okay? And we'll do anything else that you want over the time. All right, so this is an antibody molecule. Okay, how this is made is kind of a complicated genetic system, but basically every antibody molecule has two parts. It's got this part at this end. That's called the antigen binding site. Okay, that's the part of the antibody that means it'll bind to measles, or it'll bind to chickenpox, or it'll bind to the pneumococcus, or it'll bind to strep. So we all make probably millions of different kinds of antibodies, because there's lots of different things that we see over the course of our lifetime. And anything that you see that's foreign has the ability to trigger the immune system to make an antibody. Okay? Now, when you make an antibody, what you need to remember is it's just like going to Baskin Robbins. When you go to Baskin Robbins, the first thing you do is you figure out what flavor ice cream you want. Okay? And when you're making an antibody, the first thing your body does, if it decides, is it's going to have an antigen binding site, or a piece that binds to a germ. It's going to let it bind to measles, or bind to chickenpox, or bind to whatever. Okay? That's the ice cream flavor. After it, okay, you're all now being recorded, so be careful what you say. All right, after you make a decision about what flavor ice cream, the second thing that happens is that this part of the antibody molecule gets hooked up to this piece down here. This is called the heavy chain. Okay? And when the antibody molecule is synthesized, those two pieces are actually hooked together. Okay? You could make measles antibody, which is hooked up to something that makes this IgA. You could have measles antibody that hooks it up to something that makes it IgG or IgM. Or IgE or IgD. Okay? This is the part of the antibody that says this is specific for any particular germ. And after the antibody has bound to the germ, this part tells the antibody what to do next. Okay? And if it's IgA, it has different instructions than if it's IgG or IgM. Okay, everybody clear about that? And in the course of an immune response, the very first antibody that you make is something called IgM. And after you make IgM, your body can, it basically, in a gene sense, so not proteins get broken apart, but the gene gets taken apart and can get hooked up to a different part of the gene. And instead of making an IgM antibody, you make an IgG antibody, or an IgA antibody, or an IgE antibody. Okay? Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about any antibodies but IgA, but I want to just tell you that in general, if this is IgG, or it's IgM, and it binds to the surface of a germ, IgG and IgM cause a lot of inflammation. So IgG and IgM can cause white blood cells to stick to them and makes it easy for the antibody-coated germ to be gobbled up. IgG and IgM can activate something called complement, which is a whole series of proteins in the blood that give you an inflammatory response. So if you have IgG on the surface of a germ sitting here, one of the things that happens is that you'll get pus at the site, because as complement gets activated, it gets lots of white blood cells to leak out of the blood vessels and move into where the germ is. Okay? It causes the blood vessels to get leaky. It causes white cells not only to kind of non-specifically go through the leaks, but it actually attracts white blood cells. So IgG and IgM are what I would call inflammatory. When you get IgG or IgM on the surface of a germ, you get inflammation, you get a lot of fuss. Okay? If this is IgE, and you have the misfortune of making IgE, let's say you make IgE to ragweed, and you get ragweed up your nose, you have an allergic reaction. And those are really inflammatory. So you might sneeze, you might cough, you might get asthma, you might get a rash. Lots of things happen, and they happen really quickly. All right? We're going to talk a lot more about IgA, but in general, what I want you to remember is that if IgA is over here, and IgA is coating a germ, IgA can inactivate that germ and keep it from infecting you, but it really doesn't cause any fuss in your body. Okay? It's like some kind of a stealth fighter. So IgA covers the germ up, and you sneeze it out, or it comes out in your stool or wherever it goes, but you don't usually end up with a whole big inflammatory reaction. You don't end up with pus. You don't end up with much of anything that you notice. And we'll talk a little bit about why that's so critically important. Okay? All right, so making an antibody is like going to Baskin-Robbins. You pick the germ you want the antibody to react against, and then you decide you're going to have it in a cone, a cup, or a milkshake. And in this case, you decide if you're going to have it attached to a handle that's IgM or IgG or IgA or IgE. Everybody with me? Sure? If you're not, this is a good time. We have lots of time. Okay. Yeah, you could do whatever you want. You want pictures, take pictures. If you want, I send you a copy. If you go on a lecture circuit someplace and you make a lot of money, you could give 5% back to the IDF. How's that? Okay? But only if you make a lot of money. All right. Now, a general concept is that IgA is made on the surface of mucosa. Okay? The mucosa is anything that looks like the inside of your cheek. So your mouth, the esophagus, the tube that goes down to the stomach, the small intestine, the large intestine, the rectum, the anus, so from mouth all the way down to the toilet, okay, that all of that tissue is lined by something that looks just like the inside of your cheek. That's a mucosal surface, okay? The same thing is true for the place that air goes, okay? So your mouth, your nose, the trachea, which is the tube going down to the lungs, and the lining of the airways in the lungs are all mucosal surfaces. Okay, it's a little bit like, although it's on the inside of your body, it's in contact with the outside. So if you think about it, something that's inside, deep inside your arm, has no contact with the outside. Okay, but what you breathe and what you eat, what you swallow, is really whatever's on the outside that's coming in, okay? And that's what that mucosa is interacting with, okay? And those are all the places where your body specifically makes lots of IgA, okay? So you see here, this is the nose. This is the lining of the sinuses that are attached to the nose, okay? This is probably both the airway, the trachea, and the esophagus, the lungs. This is meant to be probably stomach and small and large intestine. Okay? And milk has got a lot of IgA in it also. Okay? Another place you'll find IgA is in your tears. Again, that's a mucosal surface, and it's a kind of a place where your body is interacting with the environment directly. Those are the places where we have lots and lots of IgA. Okay? Now, in general, inside the body, like in your blood, inside your liver, inside your kidneys, mostly what you have is IgG and IgM. Okay? So IgA has some unique functions. It doesn't cause inflammation. And it's made on mucosal surfaces, which are places that, although they're inside your body, are really in contact with the outside world. This is another way of telling you the same thing. If you look at blood, you look at spinal fluid, you look at the fluid inside your abdomen, but not inside the intestine. All of those places mostly have IgG. If you look at saliva, you look at snot, you look at the mucus that's in your GI tract, you have lots of IgA and very little of anything else. Okay? And in the bloodstream, IgA is really a pretty minor component of the total amount of antibody. Okay, it turns out that over the course of a day, we probably make 3 times more IgA than any other kind of immunoglobulin. And the reason that we make so much is because it's constantly being lost, because it's on these mucosal surfaces. Okay, so you make it, but it leaks out in your tears, it leaks out if you sneeze, you lose it if you cough, and you lose it every time you go to the bathroom. So you keep making it to replenish what's there. All right, now, this is a picture through a microscope of what a mucosal surface looks like. Okay, and it doesn't really make a difference if this is intestine, or this is trachea, or this is the inside of your mouth. Okay, this is, let's say, the inside of your intestine. Okay, and this is the surface of the mucosal surface of the mucosa. Down here is where are the lymphocytes that are making the antibody. Out here are the germs. Okay, to give you an idea, a gram is about the weight of a penny. Okay, in every gram of stool, you have about 100 million bacteria. Okay, so inside of us, we have billions and billions of bacteria. And those bacteria are all just sitting here. Okay, they would just as soon come in here where it's nice and warm and there's more stuff to eat. Okay, and we have to figure out some way to keep those bacteria where they belong in the intestine. They have a role in the intestine, so they're really important for digestion. We're actually learning more and more about all the ways in which the bacteria inside of us are really important to our health. And having somebody sterile on the inside and having no bacteria in the intestine would interfere with your ability to digest and to survive, actually. Okay? But you don't want all those bacteria coming in here and causing lots of infection. So we have a problem. The first problem is that the antibody is made down here, and what we really want is the antibody out here where it's going to protect us from the germs that want to invade. Okay? The second problem that we have is we've got a lot of bacteria, and I'm going to use the intestine as a good example of this. Okay? We have billions of bacteria there. If we were constantly having a big fight with all those bacteria, and we were making pus and inflammation and all of that stuff, we would all have terrible inflammatory bowel disease. We'd have colitis, we've had Crohn's disease, we'd have something that would be awful, but it would be probably not compatible with life. Okay? And now I hope you're beginning to understand why IgA has the role that it has. When IgA binds to a germ, it doesn't call in and say, let's bring in lots of other white cells. It doesn't say, let's make a big fuss. What it does is it binds the germ, it keeps it from ever penetrating this mucosa, and it does it without any fuss. Okay, it's like you would like all your kids to be. Okay, they're quiet, they're peaceful. There's a problem, they take care of it, and you don't have to hear about it. Anybody have kids like that? I have 7, and none of them are like that. Okay, but what we want to do is get IgA. We want to get antibody from here to here. All right. Now there are some very specific characteristics of mucosal surfaces. First of all, the lymphocytes that live down here, or at least the B lymphocytes that live down here, prefer to make IgA compared to any other kind of antibody. Okay, T cells that live down here program them to do that. So most of these B cells are going to make IgA. Okay? And when they release the IgA, the cells up here have a specific receptor which binds the IgA and then transports it and gets it out to the outer edge. Okay? Now another thing that you can think about when you think about mucosal surfaces, think about your nose. Okay? What do you do? What do you make in your nose? Mucus. Okay? And you have mucus on every mucosal surface in the body. Okay? And that mucus is mostly just stuck along the outside here. So what happens is the IgA gets made here, it gets transported up to the edge, and it gets stuck in the mucus. And now you've got this slimy layer on the inside, which is sticky, and it's full of antibody. And if a germ comes in because you breathe it in, or a germ comes in because it's on the food you eat, or a germ comes in because who knows where your hands were and you pick your teeth, okay? What happens is that those germs have a tendency to get stuck in the mucus. And if IgA is there, they really get stuck. Now they're kind of inactivated. And then they just wait for you to sneeze or cough. Or actually, we have all kinds of ways of moving that mucus. Okay, so in the GI tract, as you eat, you have these contractions of the intestine that move food along from place to place as it gets digested until it comes out in the toilet. Okay, and that also moves the mucus. And so stuff that's stuck in the mucus just kind of moves out with everything else. In the respiratory tract, I'll show you a picture in a few minutes, we have tiny microscopic hairs called cilia. And those cilia, starting from the lower part of your lung, are always beating, and they beat kind of synchronously. So it's like when you're at the ballpark and you have those waves that go around the stadium. So that's what you have, is you have a wave going around the stadium. It starts out really low in the respiratory tract, and it slowly beats up, 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 and that mucus comes up. If you have a bad cold and you're making a lot of mucus, which is part of your response to having a cold, you cough it up or you sneeze it out. But every day you're doing that, you're just not aware of it because there's not enough mucus for you to really need to cough. But it moves up from the lungs, it gets into the back of your throat, and you just swallow it without paying any attention to it. Okay? So this is this mucosal surface. This is the lining of your cheek, your intestine, your airways. IgA is made here. And I've got kind of a cartoon that the kind of B cell that's making IgA is sitting down here. It makes IgA and it releases it. And the epithelial cell, the cell on the surface of the mucosa, has a receptor that's very specific. It'll only bind IgA or IgM. And it transports it right through that cell and puts it right out onto the edge. And then it gets stuck to a large extent in the mucus. Some of it floats free, but a lot of it just sits right out there acting as a barrier and a protection against any of those germs getting in. Now, it's important to remember that this transport mechanism works for IgA and it works for IgM. It doesn't work for IgG. Okay? And one of the reasons that that's important is if I put a lot of IgG into your body, there's no way that you have of transporting it and getting it from here onto that mucosal surface. Okay, that's why if you don't make IgA, I can't give you Ig something else in its place. Okay? Another thing to remember if I put IgG or IgM or IgA into your bloodstream, it's in the blood. It's not getting anywhere near this tissue. It doesn't have any way of getting anywhere near this mucosal surface. And then it doesn't have any way of getting up into the mucus. Yes? When you give gamma globulin subcutaneously, it gets picked up by lymphatics. You're exactly right. Okay? And the lymphatics put it into the veins, and it goes into the blood. Okay? So no matter how you give it, the only way you could possibly get antibody onto this surface is if you sprayed it. Okay? So maybe if you could spray it in your nose, you could have some antibody. I don't know how long it would last. Okay, because I think mostly what would happen is you'd sneeze it out. Okay? Some people can do what with IgG? Well, it's not a labeled indication. Okay? All right. Now, I'm being repetitive a little bit on purpose because I want to make sure you get all of this stuff, all right? But what happens after IgA is on the surface of the mucosa is if there's a germ around or there's a toxin around, there's a virus, it doesn't make any difference what it is, okay? IgA will bind to it, okay? It is a process then of what's called neutralization. So it largely prevents this from ever getting inside. If it gets inside, it gets inside in a way which is inactive and doesn't cause infection. Okay? All right, now, this is a picture of what the lining of your trachea looks like and the lining of the big airways into the lung. Okay? So, these are all those epithelial cells on the surface of the mucosa, and this hairy stuff is not a mold. Okay, these are actually the cilia. These are those little hairs that beat. Okay, and this is a really, really important defense mechanism. So for a lot of germs, if you inhale a lot of germs, they get into the trachea, they get stuck in the mucus, even if you have no antibody at all. They get stuck in the mucus, and these little hairs move them up and out, and they don't cause you a problem. Okay? Now, unfortunately, these are exactly the cells that the flu infects. Okay? So I'm going to show you what this looks like after you've had the flu. Okay? It looks like there's been a forest fire. Okay? When you have the flu, the cells that get infected and then die and take probably a couple weeks to recover are these ciliated cells, the cells that line the airways that move the mucus up. So very few people actually die from the flu, but lots of people die because they get the flu. The lining of the airways look like this, and when they look like this, you are very susceptible to then getting a bacterial pneumonia. So very few people die of the flu, but they die of a secondary pneumonia.
Is that why the color lasts longest?
That's part of why you have symptoms that last so long and you have this cough, because you don't have the usual way of clearing the mucus and it depends on you coughing. Okay? There's a lot of viruses that can do this, not just the flu. Yes? Probably a couple weeks. Depends a little bit on the severity of the illness, but probably 2 to 3 weeks until this is back to normal. Okay? Now, if you've got an infection going on, even if you've got normal ability to make IgG and IgM and you get over the infection, this is the result and it causes a problem. And this is exactly what IgA is designed to prevent. So the IgA, if you've got IgA antibodies against the flu and they're sitting in that mucus, when the virus gets in, it gets surrounded by the antibody it never infects the cells, and you never have something that looks like this. That's why defense on a mucosal surface is so important. All right, yes. So that's an antiviral. The way that works is if you get the flu, you don't usually have every cell that's infected. You have some number of cells that get infected. Viruses are very peculiar kinds of germs. So a virus gets inside of one of your own cells, and before it kills that cell, it takes it over. It basically tells the cell, stop doing whatever you usually do. Your job for the next day is only going to be to make more virus. So if you have one cell infected with one virus, by the end of the day, that cell has made a million viruses, and then the cell eventually gets sick and it breaks apart, and now you've released a million. And then those million infect a million cells. Each of them are now viral factories. Okay? So what Tamiflu does is it interferes with the ability of the flu virus to replicate. So even if you've got a cell that's infected, it keeps that infection from propagating to more and more cells. And it's very helpful, but only if you get it early on. Okay, once it's spread and it's all over the place, it doesn't work. That's why if you have symptoms that you think might be the flu, you go in, you get one of those rapid tests, and you get a prescription for Tamiflu. Okay, or if you're in the middle of the winter and there's a big epidemic in New Orleans and everybody who's getting sick gets the flu, if you get the right symptoms, a lot of times we will just prescribe the Tamiflu without having to do a specific test, because the likelihood is that that's what you have. All right, so does everybody here understand now what an antibody is? We could have a test. I could use those cards and pass out test questions. Okay, we do things a little bit differently than most of the other. I'll get bad ratings probably, though. So I don't think I'm going to do that. All right. Everybody understands what an antibody is. I hope you understand that IgA is a little bit different than other antibodies. It has a very specific role, which is to work only on these mucosal surfaces. It really doesn't do very much inside the body. If you've got germs that get inside, deep inside, that's the time when you want to call out all the troops. You don't want IgA around. You want to have something that calls in white cells and complement, and you get pus and you get every defense you can to fight those germs. But IgA's role is to prevent the infection from occurring in the first place. Okay, its job is to kind of surround any germs right as they hit that mucosal surface before they can cause any problems.
Kind of off the topic a little bit. When you have lower something sustained, and you get placement therapy, how come you can have reaction if it has a little pain in it?
We're going to talk about that at the end.
That's what I said, flip it off.
Okay.
So maybe think about it.
That's right. We're going to get there. All right. Now, I want to start talking about selective IgA deficiency. Okay, the very first thing to say is that it is selective as well as IgA deficiency. Okay, so to have selective IgA deficiency, you have to have an IgA level which is just about undetectable. Okay, so the level has to be either less than 5 or less than 7, and that number has to do with the machine that we use to measure IgA in the blood. Okay, so that puts it just about at the level where you can't detect it. If you have IgA, which is a little bit lower than normal, that doesn't qualify you for this diagnosis. Okay, you really have to have an IgA level which is almost undetectable. Yes?
What's normal?
Normal for an adult is probably about 50 to 150. Depends a little bit on the lab, but roughly 50 to 150. Okay?
What's the normal for a child?
Depends on the age of the child. Okay? So immunoglobulin levels start out really low, and they get up to adult levels by the time you're about 10 or 12. So if you told me you were talking about a 3-month-old,
6-year-old,
probably about, could be as low as 15 or 20. Okay? In a 2-year-old, if the level was this low, I can tell you that sometimes it's a developmental delay, and over time the numbers come up to normal. By 6, probably not going to change, but I wouldn't make a diagnosis of IgA deficiency unless it was this low. I'm sorry.
The last testing that she was undetectable.
Okay. Then she's probably got IgA deficiency.
Yeah, so it's not going to...
Be very unlikely by age 6. Okay, in a 1 or a 2-year-old, there's a pretty good chance, actually, that an undetectable IgA will become normal over time. Okay, all the immunoglobulin levels are really low when you're born. You have the ability to make any kind of antibody even before you're born, actually, but you don't need to. And until you start seeing germs, none of us make very much antibody, and the levels reach normal probably around 10 to 12 in most people. All right, so the first thing is you have to have IgA, which is almost undetectable. Yes?
Question. Once you have very low, did you age for an adult? Does it? I know your age can go down, but does it never go back up?
Depends on why it went down.
Because I was just told it doesn't go back up ever.
Well, so. It's not going to go up because you get gamma globulin. All right. So, let me hold off on that until I talk about what causes IgA. No. That's good. That's good. And I want, it's better for you to ask the questions so we get them all on the table. And I hope I'm going to cover them, but I'm not quite ready to get to that yet. Okay? All right. So, number one, you have to have an IgA level which is less than 5 or 7, so it's barely detectable or not detectable at all. Okay? The second thing is that every other part of your immune system has to be working fine. Okay? So, to have selective IgA deficiency means that your IgG level is normal, your IgM level is normal. I don't recommend it, but some people measure IgG subclasses, and your IgG subclass levels are normal. More importantly than all of those things, if you get a vaccine, your ability to make IgG antibody is normal. Okay? So if you have IgA deficiency and I give you the flu vaccine, or you have IgA deficiency and I give you the pneumococcal vaccine, whether it's Prevnar or Pneumovax, you should have a completely normal response to that. Okay? If you don't have a normal response to those kinds of vaccines, if you don't have a normal IgG level, you don't have selective IgA deficiency. You have something else. Okay? You have probably some form of common variable immunodeficiency. Okay? And you belong in one of those big rooms around the corner, probably. Okay? So that's kind of a common problem that we see a lot. People get diagnosed as having a low IgA, and it's low, but it's not almost zero. It's, instead of 40, it's 32. Okay? And I think we don't have any data to say that if your IgA is 32 or 28 instead of 45, that it makes any difference at all to your health. Okay? We have a hard enough time trying to figure out how important IgA is if you don't make it at all. But there's really just no data that says if it's 10% or 20% lower than normal that really is important. If you have IgA deficiency and you're not making IgG antibodies in a normal way, okay, you have something more than IgA deficiency. And again, that's probably a form of common variable immunodeficiency, and it's the reason that some people who are IgA deficient might get gamma globulin. We don't give gamma globulin, which is essentially a pure IgG product, to people who have IgA deficiency in order to fix their IgA deficiency. okay? But we might give IgG to somebody with IgA deficiency who doesn't make an IgG antibody well. Yes?
What if a person had a basically undetectable, you know, their IgA production, but the and they don't respond? They don't make antibodies to any of the vaccines, but they also are not IgG.
Well, I would still call a patient like that a patient with common variable immunodeficiency. Okay? So if you, I think to fit that, so part of the problem is that common variable immunodeficiency is a very broad term, and it probably includes lots and lots of different diseases. Okay, if I worked for the registry and I was trying to put together information for research purposes about everybody who had common variable immunodeficiency, I would say for the purposes of a scientific study like that, to have that diagnosis, you have to have low levels of IgG and A and M and not make antibodies. All right? But that's because it's the purposes of a study, and you want to keep that population as homogeneous as possible. If I'm trying to decide if I'm going to treat somebody with gamma globulin, my decision about treating somebody with gamma globulin has to do with whether or not they make IgG antibodies in response to vaccines, regardless of the IgG level. So I have some people who have completely normal IgG levels, get sick all the time, and don't make antibody to any vaccine. I don't know what you call that. I call it common variable. If somebody wanted to argue with me and say that's not what it is, I'll call it antibody deficiency. But those people, I think, need to be treated. Okay? I've got somebody I just saw last week. I'm actually just working on his chart this morning before I came here. Okay? And he makes a level of IgG which is 400, which is probably half of normal. Okay? He doesn't get any infections, and no matter what vaccine I give him, he makes plenty of antibody. Okay? I'm still trying to figure out why his IgG level is so low, but I don't think he's got common variable immunodeficiency, and I'm not going to treat him. I'm going to see him every 6 months. We're going to get blood tests frequently, and we're going to figure out what happens. I've got a bunch of patients like that. Okay, and some of those patients over years stop making antibody and they look like everybody else's common variable immunodeficiency and they get treated. I've got a few people like that that I followed for probably 15 years. Okay, they don't get sick, they make antibody to everything, their IgG level is low. Okay, I tell you that if I have an audience of 100 people, I'll line you all up by height. There's always five people that are the shortest in the room. I can even do that with NBA basketball players. I'm going to find the five shortest NBA basketball players, no matter what it is. But those five people might have a growth hormone deficiency, or they might have thyroid deficiency, or they might have something else. But some of those people that are short just came out that way out of the factory. I don't know why. And I have some patients that their IgG levels are lower than normal, but they make antibody just fine. Okay? So if you've got a normal G and an undetectable A and you don't make antibody, I don't think this is your diagnosis. Okay? But I do think you ought to get gamma globulin. All right, let me get a question up here first. Sometimes they're picked up by accident. So there are a number of other tests that might get done for one reason or another and lead to a decision to measure immunoglobulins. A lot of times it's accidental.
Maybe another early question. Is Sjogren's have any relation to A deficiency?
Probably. Okay, we're getting there.
That's
No, we're getting closer to all these things. We're good.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, so that's a really good issue to talk about. All right. So Especially in association with IgA deficiency, lots of people measure IgG subclasses. And there was originally data that came from Scandinavia, which said that if you had IgA deficiency and you were low in IgG 2 or 3 or 4, that you were more prone to infections than if you had IgA deficiency and all your subclasses were normal. Okay? That's now pretty old data. When it first came out, we thought that there were certain IgG subclasses that were important in making antibodies to certain kind of vaccines. And if you were missing IgG2, you couldn't make antibody to the pneumococcal vaccine, let's say, no matter what. I think we have, well, I don't want to say all. Those of us in the field, and I really think I can speak for every one of my colleagues here, have now reached a conclusion that you can make IgG antibody of any flavor. It doesn't make a difference whether it's IgG 1 or 2 or 3 or 4, as long as you make IgG antibody. Okay? So if I have somebody who has IgA deficiency, I honestly don't even measure IgG subclasses. What I do is I like to know, do they make an IgG antibody of any kind to a whole gamut of vaccines? So if you have IgA deficiency and you make antibody to the pneumococcal vaccine and you make antibody to the measles vaccine and you make antibody to the tetanus vaccine and you make antibody to the flu vaccine, you probably have selective IgA deficiency. And it's unlikely you're going to have any benefit at all from getting gamma globulin. Okay? And I make that decision based on whether people make antibody in response to vaccines. I don't make that decision based on their IgG level. Okay? So if we go back to the slide for a minute, all right? If the diagnosis is really selective IgA deficiency, you have virtually absent IgA, and every other part of the immune system, no matter what I measure, is normal. Your IgG level is normal, your IgM level is normal. If I did it, your IgG subclass levels would be normal. Your ability to make IgG antibody to all kinds of vaccines would be normal. You have normal numbers of white blood cells that crawl around and kill bacteria by gobbling them up, called neutrophils or polys. You have normal numbers of lymphocytes. If I look at the lymphocytes, you have normal numbers of T cells and B cells. If I look at the T cells, you have normal numbers of CD4 cells and CD8 cells. No matter what I look at, all of those things are normal. The only thing you're missing is IgA. Okay? If you have IgA deficiency, the critical first step in managing whatever issues you have are making sure that everything else is normal. And if everything else is not normal, then you have something more than IgA deficiency. Okay? And I don't think the name that we give the disease is so important. What's really important is when you look at an individual patient, in that patient, what is working or not working, and what do we need to do to treat them? Okay? And if somebody is only missing IgA and everything else works, they have selective IgA deficiency. If they have IgA deficiency and they don't make antibody responses to some things, and their IgG is low, they've got common variable immunodeficiency. All right? If they're somewhere in between, they're somewhere in between, and maybe I don't know exactly what to call them, but you make a decision about how to treat them and how to deal with their problems based on what you have with that patient, without worrying about what you call it. Yes?
Just for example, my daughter was called in that consultation, and we started treatments this year. And like, for insurance purposes, it is important what you call it when you start treatments.
So she
kind of evolved from selective IgA into hypogammaglobulinemia and antibody deficiency syndrome.
Yeah, so when I have somebody that doesn't make IgG antibody in a normal way, and I think they deserve to get gamma globulin, okay, I always call them either hypogammaglobulinemia or common variable immunodeficiency or something else for which insurance companies will pay for gammaglobulin. But that's a different issue is how do you make sure you get people the right treatment, okay? But neither of, I don't know if it's your two children or it's you and your child, but neither of your two families, I think, have selective IgA deficiency. You have... All right. So the first general rule is if you have selective IgA deficiency as your diagnosis, you need to be 100% sure that that's really what you have and that every other part of your immune system is working fine. Yes?
I know you said you have to make an antibody and then you should do 30 days post-vaccine when you're trying. But what happens is 3 to 6 months later, and whatever the B cell memory is supposed to
Yeah. So that's also not normal. Okay? So when I'm looking at antibody response to a vaccine, the first thing I do is I measure the antibody response 4 to 6 weeks after, and I say, can you make an antibody response at all? Okay? And there's some people that just flunk the test right at the beginning. They can't make antibody, and that's it. Okay, I also have people who make a great antibody response, but they act like an Alzheimer's patient. They don't remember. So they make a great antibody response. When you get the any vaccine, you make a ton of antibody. Okay? And then you don't keep making tons and tons of antibody. You'd be overwhelmed just making antibody. You make a ton, and then it slowly comes down. So you get to a certain point, and then at a certain point, you should plateau. So when you get chickenpox, or chickenpox vaccine, most people are immune to chickenpox forever. When you get a tetanus shot, when you get a whole series as a kid, and then you get a booster, that booster usually lasts at least 10 years. A lot of times I think it lasts 15 or 20 years, but it lasts a very long time. But I have a few patients who make a great response like this, and then 2 months later it's gone, and it's evaporated. They have no long-term memory, okay? I don't know what you call that, okay? Yes, yeah, and that's a really critical thing, and I agree with you 100%, okay? Again, your antibody level 3 or 6 months after a vaccine is not going to look the same as it looked a month after, because you make a lot and it comes down, and I would expect it to come down, but it certainly shouldn't come down to zero. All right? So that all gets back to this whole issue, okay, is if you've got the diagnosis of selective IgA deficiency, you have to be really positive that that's really right and that everything else about your immune system is working the way it's supposed to. Questions back again. Yeah, so those are definitely connected. Okay, we'll talk about that too. And if I don't get to any of these questions because I forget about them, just remind me. All right. So that's the whole issue of selective IgA deficiency. That's how you make the diagnosis. All right. Now the next thing is what causes it. And although this is a long slide, the bottom line is that almost without exception, we don't have any idea what causes IgA deficiency. Okay? There are a few drugs that can do this. And if you ever have a low IgA or an absent IgA, your doctor should always be asking if you have been on any of these drugs. The most common of all of them are anticonvulsants, so drugs that are given to prevent seizures. Okay, phenytoin or Dilantin and valproic acid are the two most common, but I think over the years basically seen almost any anticonvulsant that exists for reasons. For phenytoin, I can explain exactly why this happens. That's the only one. But anticonvulsants as a group tend to drop the IgA level And if you can get people off of a specific drug, it sometimes will come back up. Okay? But all of these drugs, this is not the same as the sulfa that you get as an antibiotic. Okay? Cyclosporine is used mostly for people who have grafts, like kidney grafts or something like that, to keep you from rejecting the graft. Gold is used for some severe cases of arthritis. Okay? But the next step after saying that you have selective IgA deficiency is to make sure that there's nothing else going on that could be causing it that could be reversible. Okay? So if you have a low level or no level of IgA and you're on one of these drugs, the first thing I would do is ask your doctor whether they could switch drugs or get you off of a drug. Okay? And sometimes that's possible and sometimes it's not. Now, I don't know of anything else that will specifically make your IgA go down and then come back up. Okay? But there certainly are viruses that can make immunoglobulin levels sometimes go down and then come back up. Okay? Who knows? There may be lots of things in the environment that may temporarily do that. People who have really severe diarrhea can lose a lot of protein in the stool, and their immunoglobulin levels can go down along with every other protein in the body. People who have a kidney problem and are losing protein in the urine can drop their immunoglobulin levels. None of those things tend to drop IgA selectively, so usually the IgA, the G, and the M all go down. And it depends exactly on what's causing it as to which one goes down more or less, but mostly they all go down, not just IgA. All right? So we don't know what causes IgA deficiency most of the time. The main reason to put this slide up is that if you've got IgA deficiency and you're on one of those drugs, you should think about with your doctor whether or not you could make a switch to a different drug and whether that would solve the problem. All right, the next question to deal with is IgA deficiency inherited. And I would say it's not inherited in any way that we can predict. Okay, we definitely see clusters of IgA deficient people within families. So if somebody in your family has IgA deficiency, it's definitely more likely that you might find somebody else in the family who has IgA deficiency. Or you might find somebody else in the family who has common variable immunodeficiency. But this is not inherited in a way like hemophilia or some kinds of severe combined immunodeficiency where I could say, if you've got it, then there's a 50% chance or a 25% chance or all your boys are going to have it and all your girls are going to be carriers. It's nothing at all like that. Okay? All right, now this is probably going to get to the questions. Okay, what are the symptoms of selective IgA deficiency? Now remember, I'm talking about people who have low IgA levels with everything else normal. And I will tell you that most people who fit into that category don't have symptoms. And I don't understand why that is. None of us really understand why that is. Okay, about 1 in 500 or 1 in 700 people walking around apparently healthy has IgA deficiency. Okay, if you go to a ball game, you know, you go to a baseball, professional baseball game or a professional football game, there's probably about 100 people in that stadium, depending on how many it holds, that have IgA deficiency. And I would bet that 97 or 98 of them have no idea that they have it. And even if they did, they would be indistinguishable from normal. Okay? Now, how do we know that? Well, we know that because when you go to give blood, they always save a little bit of blood so that it could be tested for something or other later on. And there have been studies where people have taken blood bank donors. So remember, if you're going to donate blood, you can't be ill. You can't have a chronic illness. You can't be on a lot of different medications. And basically, you're healthy if you're a blood donor. Okay? And you can find that in lots of populations around the world, somewhere around 1 in 500, 1 in 700, 1 in 800 of these apparently healthy people have IgA deficiency and had no idea. Okay? Now, that doesn't mean that people with selective IgA deficiency don't have any problems. It means that some of them do and large numbers of them don't. Okay? And our challenge is always trying to figure out why it is that some people with selective IgA deficiency have problems when others don't. So since I deal with problems in the immune system, I'm always looking really hard to make sure that somebody with IgA deficiency doesn't have something else. And if they have something else, that probably needs to be treated. Okay? But there are definitely certain diseases that occur in people with IgA deficiency at a much higher rate. So I told you about 1 in 500 people or 1 in 700 people that donates blood has IgA deficiency. If I go into a rheumatology clinic and I just look at people who have rheumatoid arthritis, not wear and tear kind of old age arthritis, but rheumatoid arthritis, okay, somewhere around 1 in 10 will have IgA deficiency. Okay, if I look at people with celiac disease, I'm not sure exactly what the number is, but the number is definitely higher than 1 in 500. It might be 1 in 75 or something like that. If you look at a variety of autoimmune diseases, Sjogren's is another one, okay, there's a higher frequency of having IgA deficiency. Now, I don't know why that is, but you have to imagine that we all go through life with lots of experiences and lots of things in the environment that happen to us more than just what's in our own bodies. Okay? So if you have IgA deficiency, not only do you not keep bacteria out of your colon, but sometimes undigested food has a way of getting in. And maybe if that undigested food is wheat and it's got gluten, maybe if gluten gets into the intestine before it's completely digested, you can get a kind of an immunologic reaction to it. And maybe that's part of why some people get celiac disease. And maybe if you don't have IgA as a barrier, you're a little bit more likely to get it. Okay? Maybe there are some people with IgA deficiency that seem to be more prone to, let's say, sinus infections than somebody else. All right? So maybe if you get enough infections with enough different viruses or bacteria, you make appropriate antibody responses and T cell responses to all of those germs. And maybe just because of bad luck, one of your responses to a germ also happens to react to one of your own tissues. And maybe that sets off inflammation that causes inflammatory bowel disease. Or maybe it sets off Sjogren's. Okay? Definitely, if you have IgA deficiency, there's an association with something called nodular lymphoid hyperplasia. Okay? So imagine that your intestines are like a hose that's just all curled up inside your belly, okay? And inside the intestines are all those bacteria, and IgA mostly keeps the bacteria in the middle, in the lumen, or the tube part, without it invading the tissues, okay? If bacteria get into the tissues, they will create kind of a regular immune response, and when you get a sore throat, your glands swell. Those are lymph nodes. And they swell because your immune system is reacting to the germs and it does what it needs to do to fight them. If you've got bacteria that penetrate the surface of the mucosa in the GI tract and they get into the tissue, you essentially are going to have exactly the same reaction. We have lymph nodes everywhere in our bodies, okay? And the lymph nodes that are along the GI tract will get enlarged because they're trying to fight bacteria that have gotten through the lining. Okay? That's probably why people with IgA deficiency tend to get this nodular lymphoid hyperplasia. That's a pretty common combination that comes together. And that one makes sense, and I can probably explain that pretty easily. It's harder for me to explain without a lot of hand-waving why you get rheumatoid arthritis. Okay, but again, a lot of us think, and I think Dr. Sullivan is going to be talking today or tomorrow about the connection between autoimmunity and immunodeficiency. And I'm sure one of the things she's going to talk about is that if you are more prone to get infections, the more infections you get, the more immune responses you get, the more chance there is that some of your responses are going to be aberrant, that they're not going to be directed just against the germ, but they may cross-react and cause some other mischief. Yes? To IgA.
Right.
Yeah. Not to Crohn's, but related to celiac disease.
Right. Do you advocate, whether it's IgA or CVID, to avoid, to a gluten-free diet or a dairy-free diet to hopefully reduce?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
No.
They say to reduce, the inflammation process, and help resolve
autoimmune. Well, when you say they say, who's they?
Patients.
Yeah. So I don't think that there's any data at all. There's data that if you have celiac disease, that you need to be on a gluten-free diet or you have a lot of symptoms. Okay, but I don't think there's any data to say that avoiding it up front has got any advantage. It's a very restrictive diet. And there are often consequences of restricted diets on nutrition. And sometimes those consequences are worse. But I'm not aware of any data at all that's been substantiated that says that being on a lactose-free diet or a gluten-free diet is a good thing to do with any kind of immunodeficiency.
Even helping the inflammation process,
you have a problem with, I don't know anybody that really has good data that says if you have a high sed rate that it's because you're drinking milk. Okay, if you've got a high sed rate, somebody's got to look for a reason for the inflammation. Okay, and I think it's really much more important to investigate and figure out the cause of that and then deal with whatever it is than to start doing all kinds of hocus pocus that sometimes causes more harm than good. Okay, I mean, there are some people who, they drink a glass of milk and they get cramps and gas and diarrhea, and they probably have lactose intolerance and they shouldn't be drinking milk. Okay, and if milk does something else to you, or there are people who they feel better when they're not on gluten. I'm not exactly sure what that means, and if that's the case, fine. But if you don't notice any difference, then you should certainly not be on a restricted diet because you think there's going to be some long-term benefit for that. We don't have any evidence that that's the case. Okay? Let's see where I am. All right. So now we probably have gone through a lot of this already. So if you want to know how you treat IgA deficiency, the number one thing is to be sure that all you are missing is IgA. So if you've got IgA deficiency and you're missing something else, it's the something else that probably has to get treated. If the only thing you're missing is IgA, we don't have a way of replacing IgA. So gamma globulin is almost, but not quite, a pure IgG product. Okay? And giving IgG doesn't make you get IgA. And putting IgG into your bloodstream doesn't get IgA onto the mucosa either. So the reasons for giving gamma globulin to a patient is if they don't make IgG antibody, and then giving them IgG makes sense. But giving gamma globulin to somebody who makes IgG antibody who doesn't have IgA just doesn't make a lot of sense, and I don't think it's a good idea. Okay? And, you know, you have to deal with whatever the symptoms the patient has. So if you've got IgA deficiency and rheumatoid arthritis, you've got to treat the rheumatoid arthritis. But you do that even if they didn't have IgA deficiency. So IgA deficiency doesn't mean, oh, you've got IgA deficiency, now I know why you've got all these things and there's nothing I can do about it because I can't treat IgA deficiency. The point is, if you have IgA deficiency and colitis, you treat colitis. If you have IgA deficiency and rheumatoid arthritis, you treat the rheumatoid arthritis. And then I think the most important thing that people need to know is that if you have IgA deficiency over a lifetime, you have an increased tendency for certain things to happen. So I can tell you that if I diagnose IgA deficiency in a six-year-old, okay, that there is a small but a real chance that over a lifetime, that person will develop into common variable immunodeficiency. Okay, I don't think those people need to have their immunoglobulins tested every 6 months or every year forever. But those parents of children, and as the children get older, the children need to know that if at any point in their lifetime, all of a sudden they start having lots of problems with infections, regardless of what the diagnosis used to be, they need to get reevaluated because maybe they have something else more than selective IgA deficiency. Maybe it's turned into a bigger, broader immune problem. Okay? If you have IgA deficiency and you or your child starts having problems with your joints, you wake up in the morning and your fingers are stiff. Okay? You and your doctor should have that IgA deficiency diagnosis in the back of your heads, and you should get to a rheumatologist probably a little bit sooner than you might otherwise, because there's an increased risk of having an autoimmune disease. Okay? And so knowing that you have this is a little bit like saying you've got a family history for high blood pressure. So make sure you get your blood pressure checked every year, and if it starts getting high, that you do something about it. Okay, I mean, I think everybody ought to get their blood pressure checked, but if you've got a family history, you're going to probably want to be a little bit more careful about that. And I think if you have IgA deficiency, it's a little bit like having that family history. It's just knowing that some things are more likely to occur to you than in somebody else. And so if you have symptoms of X, Y, or Z, you, and particularly your doctor, should be thinking about them in a little bit different context. Okay? If you have IgA deficiency and you have diarrhea that lasts for a couple weeks, I would be much faster to test to see if you have Giardia, which is a specific kind of a protozoan that you can get from untreated water that is more of a problem in an IgA deficient patient than in the rest of the population.
How do you test for that?
It's a stool test. Mm-hmm. Okay? If you have IgA deficiency and you have diarrhea that doesn't go away for a couple of weeks, I'd be a little bit more quick to think, let's get some cultures. If the cultures are negative and this is persisting, maybe you ought to get an endoscopy and maybe you ought to be sure that you haven't developed some inflammatory bowel disease. Okay? Although the majority of people with IgA deficiency are not going to get any of those things, but I would be just a little bit more aggressive of investigating symptoms that could be linked to the IgA. So, you know, it really depends on the individual patient. If you've got selective IgA deficiency, I know your IgA is low and everything else is fine and you're not having much in the way of symptoms, then I wouldn't get the levels checked again, frankly, unless something changed about your symptoms. So if all of a sudden you start getting bronchitis a couple times every winter or you get a bad pneumonia, that would be a reason to check your immunoglobulins and make sure that that IgA deficiency hasn't turned into something else. If you have an IgA level which is 30 one time and 40 another time and 25 another and it bounces a little bit, I don't think that difference is important and I would probably stop checking it. Okay, unless there's other things and symptoms that go along. Now, again, I'm not giving specific advice about a specific patient because I have to have that within the context of a whole history and a physical exam. But if I had a patient who wasn't really having symptoms, who was found to have an IgA level of 25 with no symptoms, to me that's not IgA deficiency and it's probably a normal variant that is likely not much more important than your hair color. And I wouldn't worry about it. okay? But it depends in a context of a specific patient. Yes? We're getting there. I have it. All right. I think this is my last slide. All right. And I believe that this is really a myth. This is actually a terrible thing. So there are IgA deficient patients that walk around with medic alert bracelets. And there are IgA deficient patients that come into my clinic from time to time that tell me that I've got this terrible disease and I really need X treatment, but my doctor says I'll never be able to survive it because I can't ever have a blood transfusion. Okay, this is kind of an urban legend. So let me tell you about my take about IgA deficiency and transfusions. Okay, so number one, most people with IgA deficiency, even though their level is below what's measured in that standard test, a nephelometer, if you do a more sensitive test, you 90% of the time will find a little bit of IgA. Okay, it might be 1/100th of the normal amount, it might be 1/1000th of the normal amount, but most of the time we can find a little bit. Okay, if you really have absolutely none and you get exposed to IgA, your body will recognize that as being foreign, and it's just like getting immunized, and you may make an antibody to the IgA, to that foreign IgA. If you have even the littlest tiny speck of IgA in your body, you won't see that as foreign. And so that's the reason that I think most IgA deficient patients don't ever have a problem with a transfusion, because it's really not a completely foreign protein. So that's number one. Number two, most people don't get one transfusion after the other, after the other, after the other. Okay, sometimes you might have an elective surgery and you need two transfusions one day and that's it. You might not have another transfusion for your lifetime. The people that tend to get a lot of transfusions are people who have very severe illnesses. They're people who have cancer. They are people who have who are getting a bone marrow transplant. They're people that are pretty sick. And either because the sickness itself or the medicines that are used to treat that sickness are immunosuppressive. At the time they're getting all these transfusions, they probably can't make antibody to anything. Okay? And that's another reason why I think IgA deficient patients don't have problems with transfusions. Okay? The last thing is, whenever you get exposed to something, no matter what it is, most of us make IgG or IgA or IgM antibodies. There's only a few of us that are really unlucky that we make IgE antibodies. Those are the antibodies that cause you to have serious allergic reactions. If you make an IgE antibody to IgA and you get a transfusion with that contains IgA, you can have a really, really severe, potentially even fatal reaction. Okay? And there have been two or three cases on the planet that have been written up. Okay, and Dr. Buckley actually wrote the first one of these up, and it went in the New England Journal that everybody saw and everybody thinks about. But there's not a lot more cases. So I don't want to say it can never happen, but it's extraordinarily rare. All right, to give you some sense, at Johns Hopkins, for probably a 15-year period, at least, every time somebody got a transfusion reaction, they had a whole protocol. So if there was a transfusion reaction, they would go back and double check to make sure the person got the blood that they were supposed to get and there wasn't a clerical error. They went back and they rechecked the matching to be sure that all the matching was done right. They cultured the blood to be sure that it wasn't infected. And then they tested the patient to be sure that the patient didn't have IgA deficiency, okay? And in, I don't remember if it was either 15 or 20 years, they could not attribute a single transfusion reaction to IgA deficiency. They don't do the test anymore. Okay? So I think if you are known to have IgA deficiency and you get in a car crash and you've got some terrible problem, that waiting in order to get red cells that are all washed and are less likely to cause a reaction is going to put you at much, much, much higher risk of dying than just getting the blood. So I really think those medic alert bracelets that say I have IgA deficiency, don't transfuse me, are really dangerous, frankly.